Good morning, everyone. Welcome. Nice to see everyone. This meeting is called to order November 5th, 2015 at 9:22 a.m. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, thank you. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, I just want to join all of you in welcoming everybody today. We've got a standing room only. Folks have found a place to get out of the rain, and so nice to see everybody. For those of you, this is your first Parks and Wildlife Commission meeting to attend. Just a little bit about kind of the rules of the road, if you will. We're going to kick off this meeting with a series of special awards and presentations and then recognitions of staff for their long-serving tenure and time with the agency. After that is completed, the chairman will call for a brief recess, and at that time, those of you who want to depart can do so. And then we'll open it up for the remainder of the commission meeting. And so that should happen around 10 or so. So please plan on that. For those of you who have come to stay with us for the rest of the meeting, we have a number of action items that the commission is going to be taking action on. Some of you may be here to speak on those items. If so, I would respectfully remind you to make sure that you've signed up outside at the appropriate time. When that action item is up for consideration and it's time for you to speak, the chairman will call you up by name. We'll ask you to come to the microphone. You'll have 3 minutes. Please state your name and who you represent and what your formal position is on that item. We'll have a very simple green red light system to help manage time so we can work through it as efficiently as possible. Green means go, yellow means start to wind it down, and red means eject. So help us honor that system this morning, if you will. Also, if we happen to have an agenda item for which there are a lot of speakers and you happen to be sort of late in line to be called up, if you notice that somebody else or many other people have really covered all of your points, please don't hesitate to just come up and share with the commission that you're for or against the proposal without simply repeating things that have already been said multiple times to the commission. And that way we'll make sure that the meeting is efficient as possible. So if y'all will help us with that. Last but not least, just some minor rules of decorum. I'll apologize in advance, but it is a formal commission meeting, and so if you have a conversation to have, please feel free to step outside away from the hearing room, and also, if you don't mind, just silencing your cell phones for the duration of the morning. We'd appreciate it. Welcome and thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Carter. Okay, before proceeding, I want to announce that Commission Agenda Item Number 9, Grant of Utility Easement, Brazoria County, approximately 37 acres of the Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area, has been withdrawn from the agenda. And next is approval of the minutes from the previous commission meeting held August 20th, 2015, which have already been distributed. Do we have a motion for approval? Commissioner Jones, second. Commissioner Scott, second. Commissioner Jones, any opposed?
Aye.
Okay. That motion carries, and the next is the acknowledgement of a list of donations, which have already been distributed. Do we have motion for approval? Commissioner Duggins? Second. Commissioner Morian? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Now, consideration of contracts, which has also been distributed. Do we have a motion for approval? Commissioner Martin? Second. Commissioner Scott? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. And now we have special recognitions, retirement, and service awards. Carter Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Carter Smith. As a point of departure, we are very honored and privileged today to have with us our state's land commissioner, George Bush. And General Land Office and Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, as all of you know, have enjoyed a very long-standing relationship. We have a very deep and shared interest in the future and heritage of our lands and our waters and our coast and our natural resources. They have a terrific team over there. We've really enjoyed the chance to work with the commissioner and his leadership team as he's taken over the helm there on the 2nd of January, I believe. Commissioner, probably just seems like yesterday. But we're very honored to have him with us today. He and his team have a special award in which they're recognizing one of our game wardens for an innovative project to deal with abandoned boats up on the upper coast that we hope to extrapolate down to the lower coast. And with that, let me turn it over to Commissioner Bush and have him make this special presentation. So let's welcome him. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Carter, thank you very much for having me on behalf of the Texas General Land Office. Privileged to join you all this morning to honor Sergeant Robert Waggett at this November 6th meeting. Just by way of background, for the last 16 years, under a statutory requirement, the legislature asked for the General Land Office to be the first responder to all oil spills up and down the Texas coast, all 367 miles from the Sabine Pass to the South Padre Island. Since that time, we have awarded every year to individuals, government entities, NGOs, corporations, and universities an achievement award in connection with their efforts to enhance these issues that we deal with on a daily basis, whether they be oil spill prevention, response, or educating the public, the good people of Texas. As Carter had mentioned, abandoned and derelict vessels present a huge threat to the Texas coast. They represent a threat to navigation, public safety, and to our state's environment. On-water removal costs typically run about $200 per linear foot. So, for example, a 25-foot vessel would cost upwards of $5,000, which is a large impact for a lot of our citizens. Recognizing these risks that these vessels present, the Land Office partnered with Parks and Wildlife and also Galveston County to develop a proof of concept, a pilot project, if you will, which is what we need to see more of in government, candidly, that would address the persistent abandoned vessel problem in Galveston County, particularly in the wake of Hurricanes Ike and Dolly. The partnership resulted in what we know now as the Vessel Turn-In Program, a.k.a. VTIP. Much like the Household Hazardous Waste Disposal concept, the VTIP program affords vessel owners the ability to properly dispose of their derelict vessels at no cost, thereby removing the temptation of improperly disposing their assets, whether they're usable or not. Vessels with unknown owners were cleared through a public process here at the Parks and Wildlife in order to allow for a disposal. So each of our three partner entities made substantial contributions to the program's success in just recent time. Galveston County promoted the event and utilized their equipment to compact the derelict vessels and transport these vessels to a landfill. Our agency would be involved in the proper remediation of hazardous materials from these assets, and Sergeant Waggett himself was instrumental in developing the protocols for this program to help streamline the process to clear vessels, clear their title, and then delete the relevant asset from the database in the Parks and Wildlife Registry. So at the first VTIP event earlier this year, 25 vessels were processed for disposal, which resulted in a cost savings of just over $95,000. The event also represented an excellent public outreach effort in the Galveston area, and another event is scheduled in the city of Galveston and another scheduled in Brazoria County this upcoming spring. Wherever I travel in the great state of Texas, whether it be coastal zone or otherwise, people are excited about this program and want to figure out a way to get involved. The VTIP program is a fantastic example of how government entities can work together to capitalize on our respective strengths to serve the people. On behalf of the General Land Office and the Oil Spill Prevention and Response Team, I'd like to present Sergeant Waggett with this OSPRA Award in recognition of his important contributions to the VTIP program.
Thank you, Commissioner. That's a great award, and Sergeant, we're very proud of you. You know, really, that introduction is a great segue into our next special presentation. The Commissioner talked about the importance of innovation and entrepreneurship and partnerships in state government and how important that is. And one of the greatest and most long-lasting partners for this department, of course, has been the Parks and Wildlife Foundation. And one of their longest-standing corporate partners has been Anheuser-Busch. Anheuser-Busch was the first corporate sponsor of the Parks and Wildlife Foundation, made an extraordinarily generous gift at the urging of August Bush himself to help support the conservation and stewardship and outdoor pursuits of this agency. And that partnership really has just flourished with time. And really, you can't go to any part of the state without seeing their footprints in terms of something that they've helped support. And whether it's a hatchery or a park or a public hunting area or an education or outreach program, Anheuser-Busch, through their relationship with the Parks and Wildlife Foundation, and then in turn the department, have really accomplished some wonderful things. So it was no surprise this summer when they reached out to the Parks and Wildlife Foundation and said that they wanted to launch a new contest to ask the citizens to vote for your favorite state park. And they launched that this summer. A lot of fanfare, a lot of interest, as you might imagine. You know how beloved your state parks are. But perhaps it was no surprise that the little park on the Blanco River quickly rose to the top, got the vast majority of the votes. And I'll tell you, I know I can speak for Ethan Belichick, our superintendent, that the timing couldn't have been better. Certainly, Commissioner Scott, as you well know, from Memorial Day and just those horrific floods that perched right over the Blanco River and specifically the state park and had very consequential impacts for the river and the communities in Hays County and the park itself. This was a real shot in the arm to see the park recognized that way. We're blessed to have an extraordinary friends group there at Blanco that supports Ethan and his team. And so today we've got Elliot Sparkman, who's the on-premises activation manager for Anheuser-Busch, and he's going to present a check to Ethan and the team from Blanco State Park and Annie Brown from the foundation. And so let's welcome them to come on up. So everybody. One of the better kept secrets in parks and wildlife and really state government as a whole, and it's a little known fact, is that Parks and Wildlife manages the second largest number of facilities in the entire state, just behind the Department of Criminal Justice. And so you know that. Campgrounds and campsites, marinas and fishing piers. We've got, you know, hotels. We've got restaurants, all kinds of German breweries. Explains why state parks are always in such good spirits. It's a huge diversity of infrastructure that really we have to steward. And one of the important elements of that stewardship is making sure that our capital assets reflect our mission. They reflect our conservation mission, our stewardship, and we want to manage those assets in ways that are not only are good for the environment, but also in ways that are good for our bottom line. And today we're very proud to announce a wonderful partnership with Green Mountain Energy, work with Andy Chamberlain in our infrastructure team. He manages a lot of our sustainability projects and initiatives. And they work together with our state parks team at Enchanted Rock. And Green Mountain Energy is donating this solar photovoltaic system, which will be installed on the headquarters building. We're expecting that to cut our energy usage in half, save about 50% on our energy bills, and that's real money to the bottom line there at the park. And so it's a very, very generous donation. And we've got Mark McShane, who's the vice president of Green Mountain Energy, with us today to make a presentation. Let's welcome Mark. Mark.
Good morning. On behalf of the Green Mountain Sun Club, it's my pleasure to present $40,000 donation to the Texas Parks and Wildlife to be used towards the development of a new solar array at Enchanted Rock State Natural Area, to build a new solar array at the headquarters out at Enchanted Rock. The Green Mountain Sun Club formed out of Green Mountain Energy back in 2002, and since that time, we have made over 84 donations throughout the state of Texas, totaling $4 million, and built out almost 1 megawatt of solar energy here in Texas. It's my pleasure to be here today, and we're excited to work with the Texas Parks and Wildlife, given both your regional and national recognition for conserving natural resources. Thank you.
Thank you. For our next presentation, we've got some old friends that have come in from the Shikar Safari Club International. You know this group of very prominent, distinguished sportsmen and conservationists and hunters active in wildlife conservation and our hunting heritage and our state and our country and really our world. And they're just great ambassadors for the sport of hunting and the whole model of hunter conservation. And so the Shikar Safari Club every year honors a game warden with their Wildlife Officer of the Year. And this will be the 36th year, I believe, that the Shikar Safari Club is honored a Wildlife Officer of the Year. And we could not be more proud of the fact that this year it's our very own Benny Richards. Benny has been with us for two decades, serving proudly as a state game warden in Northeast Texas. He's based up in Hunt County, which is a very busy area of the state. It's got a great mix of agricultural lands, but also that kind of rural-urban interface as the whole Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex kind of expands east. And so he stays awfully busy. Benny is one of those just consummate game wardens, has integrated himself very well into his community, involved in youth sports and youth mentoring. He's just a trusted advisor to all of the community leaders in that county who look to him for not only his law enforcement acumen, but also his leadership in the community and just a pillar of the community. His captain loves to tell the story that, Benny can never let his work quite go. He and his family recently returned home from a trip up to New York City. Literally, the plane landed at DFW. He stepped off the plane at night, got a phone call about a poaching case, raced home, put on his uniform, and before sunup, he had five people arrested and on his road to making a great case on a deer poaching incident there in Hunt County. He also had another case that he led recently that it had to do with, I'll just call them what they are, a bunch of rednecks that were riding ATVs up a little dry creek bed in Hunt County. And so they were using that waterway to ride their four-wheelers and so forth and then trespassing on farms and ranches. And Benny led a great investigation to catch those and help shut those down. Benny also recognizes the importance of communicating the important work of our game wardens, and very active. He writes an article in the local newspapers that they publish called Furry Tales about the adventures of the game warden there, and so that's a very popular series that everybody looks forward to reading each week. Last thing I'll say about Benny, I hope all of you have seen those billboards for our Operation Game Thief program. And some of them you'll have that game warden scene with a game warden looking off with the binoculars and the eyes of Texas are upon you. And Benny was the one that came up with that moniker about the eyes of Texas are upon you. And so our Operation Game Thief committee integrated that and put it on the billboards. Of course, the Eyes of Texas is obviously a proud song, something that I know that all the Aggies really enjoy singing. We're going to get Benny up here. We're going to have the former chairman of the Texas A&M Board of Regents, Bill Jones, is going to come up and lead us in singing the Eyes of Texas with Benny to help celebrate that. And so in all seriousness, we're just thrilled. The Shikar Safari Officer of the Year. I saw the Stumbergs and Danny Butler back there. Marco Barrett are here. And so we're going to ask that merry band to come up and present this award to Benny. Let's give them all a round of applause. So.
Carter, I would gladly love to join in the singing of that song, but I don't know the words and the words I would substitute, they probably wouldn't like.
I was afraid of that. Good call, Commissioner. Thank you. We've got a very special presentation now in which we're going to honor the inaugural class, the graduating class of our first Game Warden Citizens Academy. And yesterday we had a very robust discussion with the commission about the critically important role that our game wardens have played. And we really started out that discussion talking about the just extraordinary work they did serving the state as part of the Operation Strong Safety 2 related initiative. But as you know, we talked about a whole lot more than that. We talked about the extraordinary emergency response and roles as first responders and their important roles in public safety and disaster relief with recent floods in Navarro County and right here in Travis and Hayes and Caldwell counties and helping to respond to the fires over at Bastrop and Busher. And so we talked about just again the very important role that our game wardens play in terms of helping to protect our lands, our waters, our fish, our wildlife, our environment, our property, and oftentimes our lives. But we also talked about the fact that, our game wardens quietly do their work behind the scenes, and they get it done. And oftentimes that work that they do for communities throughout all of the state's 254 counties does not go as recognized or noticed as some of us might otherwise like. And so thanks to the leadership of Commissioner Margaret Martin, who really came to us about 2 years ago. She had just graduated from the FBI Citizens Academy and said, we really ought to think about creating a Citizens Academy for our game wardens in which we can go out and identify community leaders, people of influence, to really come and learn through an in-depth process what our law enforcement team does on a day-to-day basis. And so under her leadership, working with Craig and Danny and Graham and others, they put together the inaugural Citizens Academy. And we decided to focus it on really a hand-picked group of leaders in business and agriculture and government and conservation to run through the program. It was a five-month program. Every month they came together and were introduced to some element or facet of our law enforcement work, from going to see the Game Warden Training Center in Hamilton to going out with our dive team and learning about the search and rescue operations they perform, watching the canine team in operation, riding along with game wardens in the field as they did their day-to-day responsibilities out protecting their natural resources and looking out for the safety of our lands and waters and people. And it was just a great experience. And today we're going to have a graduation ceremony to thank those community leaders who took time out of their very, very busy schedules to go through the Citizens Academy. We're very proud of that. And so I want to call each of the proud alums. They all passed their finals with flying colors. And we have a little something to say thank you. Commissioner Martin, we'd like for you to come forward, and Vice Chairman, if you'll come forward as we call them out and take a picture. I'll start off with the first one, Robbie Byers. Robbie Byers, State Director for the Coastal Conservation Association. Robbie, please come forward. Our next alum is Bill Horobin. Bill's a prominent Austin businessman and rancher, supporter of our canine team and Operation Game Thief. Bill, where are you, Bill? There you are, right there. Vol Montgomery, businessman and rancher, Reveille Peak Ranch there in the Hill Country, works very closely with our law enforcement team. Vol, you here, Vol?
Yes, there you are. You
John Nelson. John's in real estate and ranching and farming here in the Central Texas area. Also chairs our Operation Game Thief Committee. John Nelson. John, you here? John.
Yeah.
Craig Rosenstein. Craig is the CEO of Lewis Energy. And so, Craig, you here with us? Yeah, there you are, Craig. Scott Sanderson. Scott is a local businessman. He's also president of the Austin chapter of CCA, serves on their state board. Scott. Our old friend Eric Stumberg. Eric's here in Austin, rancher and businessman, long-standing friend of Parks and Wildlife Department. And so, Eric Stumberg. Eric. Bob Starnes, local businessman, proud Texas Aggie. Let me get up. Okay, all right. Yeah, now we've got that done with for the morning. Also, our proud member of the Parks and Wildlife Foundation Board. So, Bob. Ben Stratman. Ben is the chief of staff for Senator Birdwell and a strong outdoorsman involved with the Young Men's Business League here in Austin and a great friend of the department. So, Ben, welcome. No stranger to this commission, Susan Houston from the Parks and Wildlife Foundation works every day to help raise funds for the department. You may not know this as just polite and demure as she looks. You know, she was a world-class basketball star at Texas State. Craig Hunter calls her the little dribbler. Susan Houston. So, Okay, I've been ordered to watch my tongue. Jay Clayburg, you're fortunate. Jay Clayburg from the Parks and Wildlife Foundation. Great friend, Jay. Bravo. Thank you. And last but not least, it's our great pleasure to really formally thank Commissioner Martin. She has just been, you know, again, not only the intrepid sponsor and leader of this program, but she served so proudly on the dais as a commissioner with all of you. To be fair, you know, we really think of Commissioner Martin as the great den mother of Texas Parks and Wildlife. I mean, she makes sure we get up on time. We've got our lunch packed, and when the bullies pick on us, she steps in their way. She never misses an event. She just lives and breathes Parks and Wildlife. She just, it's in her DNA since she grew up on the family ranch there north of Laredo in Webb County, and certainly that experience at a early age really caused her to have a very strong and fond and deep connection with our state's game wardens. And as she served proudly with all of you on the commission, she's really made a couple of things her priorities. And I love hearing the little baby in the back, sounds a lot like home, and getting kids into the outdoors and youth-related initiatives and supporting our law enforcement team really have just been at the forefront of her efforts. And Margaret, the state's game wardens and the Parks and Wildlife Foundation wanted to formally thank you for this. And we've got Robbie Robinson, who is the vice president of the Game Warden Association, with us today with the colonel, and they want to present you with a commemorative duty pistol and an honorary game warden badge. I feel absolutely compelled to tell you that that gun and badge will get you into more problems than it'll get you out of. So use that judiciously, Commissioner, would you? Commissioner, bravo, bravo. And then if I could ask all of the graduates of the First Annual Citizens Academy to come back up, and we're going to do a group picture. Kevin, don't go far. Craig? Okay, I think that's it in terms of our special presentations, and what a wonderful lineup that was. Just a great suite of partners who give so generously of their time and talents to this wonderful agency and really all sectors. The next part of our program this morning is to really celebrate the extraordinary service of three colleagues in state parks and coastal fisheries and law enforcement who have retired from the department. Collectively between them, these three colleagues have 104 years of service to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. 104 years of service. And I think, Vice Chairman, that is very emblematic of the kind of commitment and dedication and loyalty and just love of mission and place that is so well embodied by the 3,300 professionals that proudly work for all of you at the department. And so we have a chance to celebrate their careers today. And it's fitting that we'll start off with the longest serving one of them, Jimmy Rodriguez. Jimmy literally grew up in state parks. He's a native of San Antonio, served with us for 36 years. At the ripe old age of 23, he started working out at Lost Maples, a state natural area. Before that, state natural area was even open to the public, and so he was instrumental in helping to get it ready for opening it up. He moved on and became our superintendent at Guadalupe River State Park, the old Kerrville Shriner State Park that some of you know, right there on the Guadalupe River, which the city now manages, Enchanted Rock State Natural Area, which we had a chance to talk about. Also served as interim superintendent back at the Hill Country State Natural Area, Blanco State Park, and then back at Lost Maples State Natural Area. The last part of his career, Jimmy really served as a project manager serving all of the Hill Country parks, working with them on infrastructure needs, minor repairs, putting Humpty Dumpty back together again when something was broken, and just, again, proudly served those wonderful places. Just takes a great sense of pride in the state parks, very focused on future generations, not only of outdoor enthusiasts, but also employees for this department. He's just led by example. Jimmy's retired to Bull Verde there in the Hill Country with his wife of 35 years, Cindy, and now it's time for a little fishing. Jimmy Rodriguez, 36 years of service. Jimmy. Our next colleague, Art Morris from our Coastal Fisheries Division, one of our biologists, been with us for 35 years. And Art, like so many folks, again, I mean, literally grew up inside the agency. Art was hired as a technician to work in Coastal Fisheries Division down in Rockport, and so part of the team that did all of the sampling there in Aransas and Copano and St. Charles Bays. Moved down to the Upper Laguna Madre to work in the Hypersaline Lagoon for a year or two. And really, just a couple of years into his career, Coastal Fisheries recognized that we really needed a formal liaison to work with Coastal Conservation Association and anglers all up and down the coast as we launched new initiatives, considered regulation changes, so that we had somebody that really was on the front line for getting public input and feedback on things that the commission was considering. And so Art became really our fishery outreach specialist from the coast, again, all the way from Sabine Pass down to Boca Chica, working with both recreational and commercial fishermen. Many highlights of his career, but I'll mention a couple just because they really are signature projects for Coastal Fisheries and our partners. One, Art was instrumental in starting the abandoned crab trap cleanup program. And so these are these ghost traps that just get left out in the bays, and those crab traps will catch all kinds of marine organisms and kill things. And every year, Art would sponsor an abandoned crab cleanup effort, and CCA and other anglers, commercial fishermen, game wardens, biologists, communities would all pull together to help clean up those death traps in the bays, and just done a terrific job. Also, back in the 90s and early 2000s, when folks were really starting to bemoan the absence of tarpon along the coast, and folks got very interested in how do we restore tarpon back to the coast, and as all of you know, is just one of the great pinnacle experiences of any angler is, you know, catching a tarpon, particularly on a fly rod. I assure you, if Craig Hunter ever catches a tarpon on a fly rod, you'll hear about it for the rest of your lives. But Art launched a program to really engage anglers all over the coast, started this tarpon observation network where people could record observations, sightings, and catches on the internet to just give us a better sense of distribution, abundance, migratory patterns, just a wonderful citizen science-related project. And then last but not least, Art was instrumental in helping to launch our license buyback program, which has bought back bay and bait shrimp licenses, crab license buyback, and some finfish licenses along the coast from commercial fishermen as part of our conservation effort. He's a past president of the Texas chapter of the American Fisheries Society, was named as the outstanding fisheries worker for that body of professionals. Again, he just knows the coast backwards and forwards. We're going to miss him dearly. Art's not going to ride off into sunset. You'll probably find him on Padre Island National Seashore chasing a fish. Art Morris, 35 years of service. Art. All right, you heard it from Earl. Our next one, Kevin McDonald. Happy, happy, happy when you get up here. So I want to see a big smile. Kevin McDonald, 33 years of service as a state game warden. Kevin comes from a long line of public servants. His dad was a proud mayor of Corpus Christi. Many folks may remember him. His late brother, Chris, was a highly respected game warden down in Bee County, where he served for many years. And Kevin really followed in those footsteps in terms of his career as a public servant in law enforcement. Grew up on the coast in South Texas. That's his home ground. He knows it backwards and forwards, cares deeply about it. When he got out of the Game Warden Academy, he was stationed down in Brownsville for a couple of years in Cameron County, and then he moved up to Mathis in the San Patricio County, was promoted to lieutenant there in Corpus. And then in 1999, Kevin was promoted to our captain game warden down to really oversee kind of that lower and mid-coast area. I mean, that part of the state, which because of the huge, vast ranches and undeveloped habitat and the Piper Saline Lagoon and Barrier Islands and wonderful ranch country, what many people call the last great habitat, that area kind of from Petronilla Creek all the way down to El Sauz. And Kevin has led his team of game wardens proudly serving the state in that area, an amazing network of friends and relationships in the ranch country that has served this department well. They wrote that Kevin had proudly served under five different majors. I will warn you, that is classic law enforcement speak, for he outlived the bastards. Kevin
just always kept his head down and did a great job as a leader. We just couldn't be more proud of him. And I have many stories on Kevin. We spent a lot of time together in South Texas at different points in our careers, but not my most favorite story, but one of my most memorable ones of Kevin. Craig's predecessor, Pete Flores, and I had to go down to Kingsville for a series of meetings with Kevin. And when we were done meeting with a group of ranchers, we were going back up to that Kingsville, Kennedy County Airport. And Pete had ridden with another game warden and gotten there ahead of us. And right as we were about to turn into the driveway down the FBO, there was this kind of beat-up car on the side of the road, and there was this husband and wife that were outside. Terrible situation, you know, just screaming each other, and it looked like they're about to come to blows. Just absolutely horrific. The lady was holding a baby in one arm, and so Kevin quickly turned on the reds and blues, and we jumped out to intercede and stop something before it got too bad for anybody involved there. And I'll never forget following you. Kevin's about 6'8", and so you want him in a bar fight. Let me just tell you that. Kevin steps in, and they won't calm down, and they're screaming at one another. It looks like they're going to go to blows. And I'll never forget watching this. It was like slow motion as I watched Kevin reach towards the lady with this, like this, and here, you take it, which was a little baby with this very ill-fitted diaper that looked like I had put it on. The baby was very stressed, and no sooner had the baby been passed to me. That was the job Kevin clearly thought the executive director should do, take care of the baby and get out of the way, sir. It just came out of both ends, all over my shirt. And I looked down, I'll never forget, and I looked over, and there was Pete Flores with his binoculars watching the whole thing, doubled over in laughter on the tarmac. Kevin's been a great friend of this agency, proudly served us. He hadn't ridden off in the sunset. He's got a wonderful ranch in Jim Wells County. He's now a captain for the Jim Wells Sheriff's Department, oversees their reserve deputy program, stays involved with law enforcement down at the King Ranch. Very proud of Kevin. 33 years of service. Kevin McDonald. Kevin. We're going to now go into our service awards, and we have a chance to really honor some distinguished colleagues, again, who've given so generously of their talents over the years. And it's fitting that we start off with Chris Beckham in State Parks. Chris has been with us for 3 decades. You may not have had a chance to meet Chris, but I assure you, you've seen his handiwork. Chris is our lead planner for State Parks, and so he really is the one that helps to shape the footprint and design and development of parks literally from one end of the state to the next. And throughout his proud career, he's developed plans for Cooper Lake and Government Canyon, Mustang Island, Big Bend Ranch, Paladura Canyon, the World Birding Center, Devil's River State Natural Area, and of course right now he's working on the Palo Pinto Mountains State Park west of Fort Worth. And so Chris just brings a wonderful suite of skills, bringing stakeholders together to try to identify what people want in their state parks, what kind of amenities, what kind of infrastructure, and how best to fit that on the land and be sensitive to the important natural and cultural resources that we're charged with serving. Chris has had a wonderful career with us, and we honor him today for 30 years of service in state parks. Chris Beckham. Chris. Our next colleague, John Thomas, also from State Parks, also been with us for 30 years, and really all of that time in Deep East Texas. John's been one of our great leaders over there. Very fortunate to have him on our team. Started off as a park ranger in 1985 at Caddo Lake State Park. He was then promoted to a regional interpretive specialist, and John really helped lead this statewide effort to help enhance our educational interpretive efforts, working out throughout all the parks in the state, working in concert with our wildlife biologists at some of the WMAs, again, helping us develop really the best educational and outreach programming for the millions of visitors that come and visit the state parks each year. In 98, John transferred to the Star Family Home Historical Site, where he was superintendent and proudly led that historic site for a number of years. And then in 2005, John moved over to Dangerfield State Park. And Dangerfield State Park, of course, is one of the state parks built by the men of the Civilian Conservation Corps. And back in 2007, when we got some significant infrastructure funding, Jessica, that Dangerfield State Park was front and center for us in terms of helping to remodel and renovate really all of the facilities on site. And John just played a great role in terms of helping to preserve that historic infrastructure and make sure that it will continue to last for future generations. And we're proud to honor John today for 30 years of service. John Thomas, John. Our next colleague from Coastal Fisheries is Dr. Robert Vega. Robert, again, just this decades-long career with us, literally grew up inside Parks and Wildlife as well, got his bachelor's degree in biology from A&M Galveston, and then his master's degree there at what was then Corpus Christi State University, I guess, prior to being A&M Corpus Christi. Got his master's degree, came to work for us as a technician at what we call the CCA hatchery there that we have in partnership with CCA there in Corpus. And Robert started working there at the hatchery, quickly moved his way up, was promoted to hatchery manager, and then several years later, Robert was promoted to his current position, which he's held since 1992. Robert oversees all of our three coastal hatcheries, which, as I told you yesterday, you know, produced upwards of 30 million fingerlings last year to put out back in our bays of redfish and trout and southern flounder. Robert's been on the leading edge of that. One of the things I love about his background is he's never stopped learning. And while working full-time for Parks and Wildlife, overseeing all of the hatcheries on the coast, Robert went back to College Station part-time and completed his PhD. He's a very well-revered scientist in the hatchery community. He's published over 40 papers in peer-reviewed journals. He's really a go-to guy all across the world for folks to come to learn about culture and propagation techniques in hatchery-related settings, and you won't meet a nicer guy. Dr. Robert Vega, 30 years of service. Robert. Our next colleague, Monica Davenport. Monica has been with us for 25 years, and Monica literally is a colleague that is on the front lines for us. She works for our law enforcement team out in Galveston County there in the Lamarck office, but really for her first 22 years, she was our office manager there in Freeport, working for our law enforcement team. She was the only one in that office. And so for literally 22 years, dealing with folks that were coming in, commercial fishermen, recreational anglers, boaters, she was our representative in Freeport. Just did a terrific job there representing the department. At one point in her career, when we had created the limited entry program for commercial fishermen, she noticed some mischief going on in that program, and obviously worked with the game wardens to get that stopped, and very proud of her for that, for folks that were trying to abuse the license privileges. In April in 2012, Monica transferred to the Lamarck office, where she continues to work in her administrative role there as an administrative assistant, and again, front lines for the department interfacing with the public. Critically important role. Monica Davenport, 25 years of service. Monica. Our next colleague, Merida Cuellar, budget analyst inside our state park system, also been with us for 25 years. Merida had a distinguished career really with the Air Force and retired for that from the Air Force, came to work for the department and what at that time we called the planning and design section. Jessica, a little trivial pursuit for you. That's now our infrastructure division. She then moved over to our administrative resources team, Mike, and worked in contracting and procurement and administrative related functions, worked in accounting accounting, federal grant billing, budgeting, all of the back office stuff that we just have got to have to make the ship run. In 2006, Meredith transferred over to our State Parks Division. She's held a variety of positions there, but she's now our lead budget analyst, and so critically important role of supporting Brent and his leadership team there in State Parks. In 25 years of service, State Parks, Meredith Quellar. Meredith. Our next colleague's also been with us for 25 years in State Parks, Zia Corpus, and Zia started out his career there at Pernalis Falls and was there for a couple of years and then moved over to LBJ State Park and Historic Site, and that's where he has proudly served for 23 out of the 25 years, and he's had all kinds of jobs there, working initially as a seasonal. He was on the maintenance team, worked on the tour center team, working along the National Park Service, who's obviously our neighbor there at the LBJ site. He was a lifeguard during the summers there at the pool, then became a clerk at the site, and again went back to working for the tour center desk. Again, really is the person that people would go to get information about the park. Where can they drive? Where can they walk? What can they see? Zia is really the one, again, on the front lines that's the face of the department at the park that people go to for information. We changed his title in 2013 as a customer service rep, which I think reflects the important commitment our State Parks Division has each and every day to give an exemplary customer service to the 8 million visitors that come and visit their state parks. We're proud that he embodies that. Zia Corpus, 25 years of service. Zia, please come forward. Our next colleague, Cindy Hobson, has also been with us 25 years, one of our fisheries biologists. Cindy started out in inland fisheries and where she launched her career over in East Texas. When Cindy came to work for us, Craig, she was the first female biologist working on one of our management teams in the state, and so proud of her for helping to break that barrier. She worked over in East Texas with the fisheries management crew for a couple of years, and then she moved to Tyler, working on our kills and spills teams. And so when there were spill-related events and we'd have mortalities of fish and other organisms, Cindy would work on that, on assessing the damage and cleanup and remediation. In 93, she moved over to San Marcos, again, with our kills and spills team, but really focused on water bodies in central and west Texas. And then since 1997, she's worked on our water quality team and make sure that the state water quality standards as promulgated by the Commission on Environmental Quality sufficiently reflect fish and wildlife-related concerns with the development of those standards. She's been also instrumental in helping to put in place a seagrass monitoring program. We know how important and critical that is for our habitats on the coast. And Cindy just been a very valuable biologist for our coastal fisheries team. 25 years of service. Cindy Hobson. Cindy. Our next colleague, Annette Sutka, is with our inland fisheries team, and she too has been with us for 25 years, all at the Heart of the Hills Research Station there at Mountain Home. Just that's a old historic hatchery that Craig, I guess, was what, built in the 30s, late 20s, like 1927. Yeah, really amazing aqueduct fed by a spring. It's just really a fascinating place. She's been our staff services officer there. Started off as an administrative assistant there at the Heart of the Hills. She's, again, constantly working on professional development. She's a certified Texas procurement manager. She's one of only three employees, Craig, in your division that's a certified procurement manager. That means she can buy stuff. Be nice to her is my words to you. But she does a whole lot more than that. She works with this little merry band of researchers and biologists out at the Heart of the Hills, and it's this great team of biologists that are working on things, and they're always needing help with their administration and managing stuff and finding papers and research and networking with researchers all around the world, and there's never a task that's too big or small for Annette, and we're proud of her service to our inland fisheries team. 25 years of service, Annette. Bravo. Our next colleague is in our information technology division, been with us for 20 years, Arnie Montemayor. And Arnie has a great history, grew up down in San Diego there in Duval County, home of Ballot Box 13 for all you political junkies. And Arnie's family's been deeply rooted there for a long time. Arnie did go off to the University of Texas. So he actually can sing "The Eyes of Texas Are Upon You." We won't let him get too close to this mic, though. Arnie graduated from University of Texas, came to work for the Parks and Wildlife Department, really was our first hub coordinator inside the agency, then was responsible for creating an audit program over our procurement cards, and so did a great job in terms of setting that up. And then as we were creating our first automated financial system, hard to imagine that just happened in the last 20 years, that Arnie was really responsible with helping to interface with clients, help to develop that that system, and he moved over at that time to our information technology related division. And since then, Arnie's been our manager of customer service, so the help desk, all the IT support. And so Arnie is really George's liaison to everyone inside this agency. If there's a meeting around the state, Arnie is there. He's always here to help, always has a smile on his face. He's just much embodies the wonderful spirit of this agency and just brings a great initiative and work ethic every single day. Arnie Montemayor, 20 years of service. Arnie. Okay, last but not least, Kelly. All right, you're out here. Good. Kelly Simon. Kelly's been with us for 20 years as one of our wildlife biologists and just, again, has a very long and distinguished career. Started out in our non-game and urban wildlife program in which she was the coordinator of the Texas Wildscapes program, and that really is working with folks, again, in urban areas to help them cultivate wildlife habitat in their backyard and their gardens. You know, we talked about this yesterday with the monarchs, that anybody can participate in that recovery effort. It doesn't matter how much land you own. And Kelly was on the front lines of helping to launch that program. And if you go into Barnes & Noble or really any bookstore, you can see this wonderful book that she wrote on Texas Wildscapes is the author. So it's a great resource for folks that want to have ecologically appropriate and adapted plants to plant, again, to help enhance habitat in urban settings. She worked for us as an urban wildlife biologist in the non-game and urban wildlife program, transferred over to Region 2 over in Bastrop, in which she worked in Bastrop and surrounding counties, came back to the wildlife diversity program, is again one of our non-game and urban biologists. She's a proud alum of our natural leaders class, worked on a big project on alternative funding sources that she helped the agency with. Kelly's also, at various parts of her career, been on the front lines with us, like the Lost Pines recovery team after the devastating 2011 fires. She's worked on Houston toad issues. She's been our representative on the Texas Invasive Species Coordinating Council, Lower Colorado River Refuge Board. She's just been a great ambassador for wildlife to the people of Texas, and proud to call Kelly Simon a colleague. 20 years of service. Kelly. Mr. Vice Chairman and Commissioners, that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Carter, and thanks to all those involved. This is always a special time for us. At this time, let's take about a five-minute recess, and then we'll resume with the agenda at that time. Let's reconvene in about 5 minutes. Thank you.
Ahead and reconvene at this time. I want to just thank everyone for waiting through our service awards. I know we had a lot of folks here today who waited very patiently, so just want to convey our appreciation for that. Item number one is approval of the agenda. Do we have a motion for approval?
So moved.
Moved by Commissioner Jones, second by Commissioner Scott. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Action item number two is the election of a vice chairman. Do we have any discussion by the commission?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to nominate the continuation of Ralph Duggins as vice chair.
We have a motion for Ralph Duggins as vice chair, second by Commissioner Morian. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Well, Ralph, motion carries. Looks like you got through again. Great. I appreciate all your service and everything you've done. You've given a lot to this commission and this agency, and and we're all better for it and appreciate it very much. Item number three is...
Did I miss that?
Yeah, you missed it.
You can still vote no if you like, just for the record.
Should we start over?
I vote enough.
There you go. Item number three is our youth hunting program. Justin, would you please make your presentation?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. For the record, my name is Justin Drivables. I'm the Private Lands and Public Hunting Program Director. Since 1996, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department has partnered with Texas Wildlife Association to offer safe educational hunting opportunities for youth on private land across the state through the Texas Youth Hunting Program. It's a partnership that the department's very proud of, and we appreciate the opportunity to highlight the program today. I'd like to welcome the director of TYHP, Chris Mitchell, and a couple of his special guests to make a presentation to you.
Thank you.
Chairman and Commissioners, we really appreciate the opportunity to give you a little report on the Texas Youth Hunting Program. I provided each of you a little card that has our stats on there. And it also includes a little thumb drive on there. We had one young man who participated in our hunt that could not join us today, but he made a video. And it wasn't of a good audio quality to show in a big auditorium like this, so I put it on that thumb drive for you, and I would encourage you to please watch it. Shiv Ghosh is from Colorado, and he joined us on one of our hunts. And we invited him to come speak at the TWA convention, and his dad made a video of his presentation, so we'd encourage you to watch that. As far as the statistics from last year, we conducted 218 hunts, taking over 1,600 youth across the state on safe educational hunts. And, of course, we did that with the help of 133 landowners. And those aren't just private landowners. Those are also federal and state agencies and non-governmental organizations. And, of course, we also could not do that without the help of our large volunteer base. We have over 1,600 trained hunt masters since we began the program in 1996. And collectively, our volunteers and our landowners have helped us take over 58,000 people on outdoor experiences all across the state. What I'd like to do now is introduce you to our credentials. These numbers are all real nice, but our credentials are the young people that participate in our hunts. And to my left, I have Julie Krebs. She's from Kerrville. In addition to being a TYHP hunter, she's also participated in Texas Brigades. And I'll let her speak first, and then I'll introduce you to our to Monica Pena to my right.
Hello, my name is Julie Krebs. I am a sophomore at Harper High School in Gillespie County, and I am thankful for the opportunity to be able to speak to you today. I have been grateful to be a part of Texas Youth Hunting Program and Texas Brigades for several years. I have gained a lot of knowledge from these programs about conservation, preservation, land stewardship, leadership, and teamwork. Through these programs, I have learned that to make a difference in the future, it starts with my generation and I to make that difference. Even though I have been a part of Texas Youth Hunting Program for several years, I only have gone on a youth hunt once, participating as a hunter 2 years ago. My hunt was an exotic hunt in Rock Springs on a wonderful and beautiful property. There, I saw many beautiful animals, and I have made an everlasting bond with one of the hunters. Even though I did not harvest an animal, I have gained many friendships from that trip and an everlasting memory and story with my father. My dad is a hunter safety instructor and has made a youth hunt in memory of my brother, the Jacob Krebs Memorial Youth Hunt for Wounded Warriors. My brother was also a hunter ed instructor like my father. He enjoyed the outdoors and cross country, but my brother longed to be in the military, particularly being a Navy SEAL. Before my brother died, he volunteered in numerous youth hunts, including the Cave Creek Super Hunt. Since then, my dad has started the youth hunt to honor our fallen heroes by giving their children and themselves an opportunity to experience the great outdoors. I have been a part of this youth hunt since the beginning, and I enjoy greatly volunteering wherever needed, and I've seen firsthand the impact that TYHP has brought upon others, and I'm beyond grateful for TYHP and all that they have done. I have even recently been awarded the Texas Wildlife Association's Youth Volunteer of the Year because of my dedication and volunteer service to TYHP. I also was nominated because of my willingness to do any job at my brother's youth hut and because of my promotion of the Texas Brigades program as well. John Muir wrote, "When one tugs at a single thing in nature, he finds it attached to the rest of the world. I have found out that each program I have been a part of has tugged on everyone's lives that they have impacted, including mine. Texas Brigades has tugged on my ability to become a better leader and speaker, and Texas Youth Hunting Program has tugged on my ability to share the value of enjoying and managing nature, seeing different wildlife, and creating new friends. You have tugged on so many different people and organizations that in turn impacts others beyond realization. I would like to thank you personally for your generous and invaluable support towards TYHP. Thank you for letting me speak to you today. Do you have any questions? If so, I'd be glad to answer them."
Julie, thank you. Any questions for Julie?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And as I mentioned, this is Monica Pena. She's participated in a couple of our hunts, and I met her on a spot and stalk hunt that we did in Blanco a couple of years ago and was just really impressed with her. And so I'd like to give Monica an opportunity to tell you her experiences. Thank you, Monica.
Thank you. Hello. First of all, I would like to express my appreciation for the commission and for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for the Texas Youth Hunting Program and the opportunity that it offers to young people of all ages to get outside and have fun and enjoy each other's company. I'd also like to share my hunting experience with you. I met such nice people over the weekend who made it so much better. The volunteers and the cooks and the hunt masters and the landowners who were incredibly generous with us. And I also learned so much on the youth hunts. The ethics of the responsible hunting was one of the main points that I walked away with. Also, last year in my freshman year of high school, I took biology. And I dissected a deer, and it was really, really, it was amazing because it really brought to life the biology course that I took. And it was amazing because we did not waste any of the deer. And then also, I learned a variety of life skills, such as making fire, tracking the animals, and not making. It also gave me a chance to bond with my family. My very first hunt, I went with my grandfather, and it was very special, and we both had fun, and we both enjoyed it so much. My second hunt was with my dad, and that was incredibly special, too. Both experiences were unique and memorable in their own way. And I believe that Texas Youth Hunting Program has made a positive impact on a lot of kids, including myself. Personally, I have gained a greater appreciation for nature, because when you're in the blind and you're listening to the birds singing, it just takes you to a different place, and it's so special. And it was really cool to see different people coming together from all over Texas, and we were all learning, and we were all bonding with our parents and grandparents, and we were all having fun at the same time. Again, thank you for your time. God bless.
Monica, thank you. You both exemplify what's great about this program, and we really appreciate your leadership. Thank you. Commissioner Duggins.
I have a quick question for you young ladies. Where did you, or how did you get your hunter safety course? How did you accomplish hunter safety? Just out of curiosity.
My dad taught me on our property since he's a hunter ed instructor, and I've been going to many of his camps, so to speak, and I've listened on his lessons and hunter ed instructor and ethics and everything.
Ms. Pena?
And my dad took me to Red's Shooting Range in Austin, and they have hunter safety courses there.
You took it at a shooting range?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I second the chair's comments. This is just so great to hear young people get up and tell us those things. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you. Okay, action item four is approval of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department fiscal year 2016 internal audit plan. Ms. Cindy Hancock.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Cindy Hancock, Director of Internal Audit. Texas Government Code 2102, also known as the Texas Internal Audit Act, requires the annual internal audit plan to be approved by the Commission. I'm here to request approval for the fiscal year 16 internal audit plan as listed in Exhibit A. Exhibit A shows fiscal year 15 carryover projects and our new projects for fiscal year 16. This exhibit also shows the number of hours estimated to complete these projects, and it has an alternative project that can be substituted or added if time permits. Staff recommends the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission approves the TPWD fiscal year 2016 internal audit plan as listed in Exhibit A.
Any discussion or questions for Cindy?
Mr. Chairman, I move for adoption of the audit plan as presented by Ms. Hancock, and I've reviewed it and talked to Cindy about it during the interim break.
Moved by Commissioner Jones, second by Commissioner Morin. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Cindy, thank you.
Thank you.
Item number five is implementation of legislation during the 84th Texas Legislative Session, House Bill 721, relating to hunting and fishing license waiver for a certain disabled veteran. Justin Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Justin Halverson, Revenue Director. Commissioners, the action item I'm presenting today is simply a cleanup housekeeping issue from the past legislative session. The agency offers a super combo hunting and fishing license at no cost to military veterans with a service-connected disability above a certain threshold. That disability rating prior to fiscal year 16 was 60% or higher. House Bill 721 from this past legislative session dropped that down to 50% or higher. That's effective as of 2016. The administrative code currently reflects the old 60% rating. Our proposal is to replace the exact disability rating in the TAC code and replace it with a reference to statute, in this case, Parks and Wildlife 42012. That way, in case there are any subsequent changes to the disability rating, we don't keep having to bring this issue up as an action item. The proposed rule was published in the October 2nd, 2015 issue of the Texas Register. As of Tuesday, October 27th, and actually these numbers haven't changed as of this morning, there were 23 in favor, 3 opposed. One commenter noted that it complicated the reading of the law to have it reference the statute. The other two in opposition either didn't comment or their comments weren't relevant. Therefore, staff recommends the approval of the following motion. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopts amendments to 31 TAC 53.3 concerning combination hunting and fishing license package with changes as necessary to the proposed text located at Exhibit A as published in the October 2nd, 2015 issue of the Texas Register, issue number 6855. That concludes my prepared remarks. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Justin? Commissioner Scott.
I'd just like to move that we approve this. I'll make a motion.
Okay, motion for approval. Commissioner Scott, second.
Second.
Commissioner Jones, all in favor? Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Action item number six, chronic wasting disease recommended adoption of interim proposed rules. And before Clayton makes his presentation, I believe Mr. Smith has some clarifying comments to make.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And just commissioners, as we discussed yesterday, and I think this is really important that you have a chance to hear this again from me as well as all of the many stakeholders out in the audience, the proposal that Clayton is going to be laying out in front of you is not intended to be a permanent rule. This is an interim rule, one to provide continuity through the existing hunting season. It's exactly what we told the stakeholders we would be doing. We have a proposed sunset date on these rules of the 31st of August, but I want to explain that because It is our intention, with all of the wealth of information and data that we have been collecting in concert with our landowner and hunting partners, both of captive and free-ranging deer, to utilize that information along with a much more thorough epidemiological assessment to be able to come back in March to this commission with a proposal on a new set of rules relating to this subject. At that time, we'll have a proposal, certainly, that everybody will have a chance to see and comment on through the normal regulatory process. And then the hope is that in May, we'll come back to you with a formal proposal for adoption. So at that time, the commission can choose to adopt rules that will provide clarity and business certainty for all of the many stakeholders that have an interest in this. So I want to be abundantly clear about the timeline and the process that we're laying out in front of you.
Thank you. Thanks, Clayton. Go ahead. Appreciate
it. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, I'm Clayton Wolf. I'm the Director of the Wildlife Division. This morning we're going to ask you to consider for adoption these interim rules for breeder deer movement and liberation. Also, I want to point out again that in the room we have some staff from Texas Animal Health Commission with us. We have Dr. Andy Swartz. He's the Assistant Executive Director and State Epidemiologist. And also we have Mary Ludeker. She's the Assistant General Counsel over Governmental and Industry Relations. And as I indicated yesterday, these rules and the development on the short time frame just would not have been possible without their partnership. They were here and became very familiar faces at this building as we were over at the Texas Animal Health Commission. Truly a partnership that we really appreciate. We appreciate their expertise, their professionalism, and their dedication and their involvement in the development of these rules. As I mentioned yesterday, and this is going to be a bit more abbreviated, the rules that we're asking you to adopt this morning really establish three transfer categories or three different levels of movement qualification status, and then associated with those release site requirements that are associated with the release of deer from these different transfer category breeding facilities. I also showed you this graphic here, which basically demonstrates the model that we adopted to develop these enhanced testing requirements, wherein we recognize that someone with a TC1 status or the highest level of testing out there that really helps to mitigate risk for disease transmission. And so with the release of a deer from a TC1 facility, which creates a Class 1 release site, the testing requirements on that release site are the lowest. In fact, in this particular case, or in our rules, there are no testing requirements at Class 1 release sites. So we move forward to the TC2 facilities, transfer category 2, have a moderate testing performance. And so to compensate for that, the testing requirements at the Class 2 release sites are at a moderate level. Enhance also on TC3, that is the lowest testing performance within breeding facilities. And so to offset that, the testing requirements at the release sites are their highest. And so I'll go through the information I covered yesterday. For TC1 category, those would be certified or fifth-year status herds. These are herds that are enrolled in a Texas Animal Health Commission CWD herd monitoring program. And, of course, these herds must have a reconciled herd inventory, and they cannot be a Tier 1 site. You will recall a Tier 1 site are these sites that received CWD-exposed deer. And Class 1 release sites have no additional testing requirements. The Transfer 2 category is really the new category or the new threshold that we established in the rules. In order to qualify as a TC2 breeding facility, you must test 4.5% of the average population in the facility over the last 2 years. These facilities also must have a reconciled herd inventory and not be a Tier 1 site. Individuals may choose to voluntarily sacrifice animals if they're not at that TC2 level but wish to be at that level. The release sites associated with TC2 then are obligated to Class 2 release site testing requirements. If deer are released on a ranch and it becomes a Class 2 release site, they must test 50% of the hunter-harvested deer in that season or a number equivalent to 50% of the breeder deer that were released that year. Irrespective of those first two bullets, they must test 50% of the breeder deer liberated and harvested in the same season. And for a transfer category 3, 20% of the eligible mortalities in that facility since May 23rd, 2006 must be tested and have a result of not detected. Those rules were established on May 23rd, 2006. These were the standards that have been in place since that time. And so many folks were operating by these standards. And when we were able to reactivate TWIMS, everyone that met these standards was at a minimum able to meet the TC3 status on September 24th. TC3 breeding facilities must also have a reconciled herd inventory, as opposed to TC1s and TC2s, these Tier 1 sites, these exposed herds may be in the TC3 category, provided that they abide by the provisions within their Texas Animal Health Commission herd plan. And the Class 3 release sites, as I said, have the highest testing requirements. The harvest on these sites, 100% of the hunter harvested deer must be tested, or they must test a number equivalent to the number of breeder deer released that year, whichever is greater. And in addition, all deer released on Class 3 sites must have an RFID tag or a USDA National Uniform Ear Tagging System clip tag. Just a few other general provisions. A deer breeding facility assumes the status of the originating facility from which it received deer if that facility is of lower status. All the release sites must be high-fenced. And the Class 2 and Class 3 release sites must maintain a daily harvest log on site. All those provisions are in the existing emergency rule that was filed and effective August 18th. Since that time, there were several questions come up and discussions, and one of those questions was about new breeding facilities. We had, during that exercise, we had been assigning folks a category or status level and sharing that information with them, but the question was asked, what about new breeders that do not already have a testing performance? And so the rules that we're asking you to adopt this morning also establish that a new breeding facility will inherit the lowest status from among all facilities from which it received deer. Also, if a facility has its status dropped because it received deer from a facility of lower status, the question was asked, how long must that facility stay at that lower status? And the rules that we're asking you to adopt would specify that period at 2 years. And then for new facilities, the new facility status would be calculated after 2 years. Obviously, though, as Carter Smith indicated, we're going to be revisiting these rules in January. So there's no certainty on where we're going forward. This may be changed as we evaluate the rules with our stakeholders and our partners at Texas Animal Health Commission. And then finally,
on the first bullet point, a new breeding facility, if a new facility acquires deer from two different sites that have different classifications, what would happen hypothetically in that case?
They would assume the status of the facility with the lowest classification. So if they got deer from a TC2 and they got deer from a TC3, when they opened their facility, they would become a TC3 breeding facility.
Okay. Thank you.
And then, as Mr. Smith indicated, these rules, and these are not in the text of the draft of the rules that were submitted to the Texas Register, but an amendment that we're asking you to consider as well as an expiration date of August 31st, understanding that, as Mr. Smith said, our process, we plan to be back in front of you in March with proposed rules and in May to consider those proposed rules for adoption. As of 7 a.m. this morning, the public comment, primarily through the web, was 678 that agreed, supported the rules, with 372 opposed to or disagreeing with the rules. We also received a letter that I reported to you yesterday that had numerous signatories. I have those on the screen here in front of you, and I will scroll through those as you see them. There were 26 organizations or associations on that first letter. This morning I was presented with a new version of that letter. It's basically the same letter, but it has three additional signatories on that letter in addition to the 26 that are on the screen here, and that includes the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, the Council to Advance Hunting and Shooting Sports, and the Texas Agricultural Land Trust are also now signatories to that letter of support. We also received individual letters of support from organizations and associations, to include East Texas Woods and Waters Foundation, the Texas Conservation Alliance made a web comment, Ducks Unlimited, Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association, and King Ranch. And then we received a letter from Texas Farm Bureau that didn't necessarily speak specifically to the rules, but it we would categorize it as a letter of support. When they submitted the letter, they said it was in reference to our chronic wasting disease rules. And I'll just read the third paragraph. Farm Bureau policy favors Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and the Texas Animal Health Commission addressing the disease problems associated with interstate and intrastate shipment of native wildlife, particularly those related to hunting, to the hunting economy of Texas. Additionally, the Farm Bureau policy supports continued research to develop a live test for CWD, which, of course, we will be thoroughly investigating at the beginning of the year. We also received a web comment from Texas Deer Association in opposition to the rule. And if we look at the reasons, the more common comments, we did have 106 comments that were identical or nearly identical, rather lengthy comment. But in essence, the comments on the web indicated that they did not feel that there was no longer an emergency because of where we were in our testing, that there was no considerable threat, that current testing requirements were injuring industry without just cause, and specifically, in addition to just asking the commission to consider the rules, the adoption of the rules in their entirety, there is a specific request to dispense with Class 2 release site testing. Other more common themes, the numbers here are probably will be updated a bit because this is from yesterday morning and we weren't able to keep up with everything over the last 24 hours. But the common themes, there were some in opposition to the rules because the individuals are opposed to deer breeding in general, or the rules were not stringent enough. Some felt that this was agency overreach and overreaction. There were some that believed that the rules required deer to be sacrificed. Others indicated the rules are punitive and single out deer breeders. And of course, as we make the reference to live animal testing, several believe that the rules should allow for live animal CWD testing. A few more comments that testing requirements should be the same for all deer. And then we had some more comments, individual comments that weren't the form comments, opposing release site testing, and also commenting that they did not believe that there was an emergency. And then in general, just scanning through the comments, there were a few that indicated that the rules would have a negative impact on the economy, on deer breeders, land value, and local economies and such. And so the motion that we're asking the commission to consider this morning is the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopts new 31 Texas Administrative Code section 65.90 through 65.93 concerning disease detection and response, with changes as necessary to the proposed text, which is located at Exhibit A, as published in the October 2nd, 2015 issue of the Texas Register. And with that, I'll be glad to take any questions or step aside for public comment.
Thank you, Clayton. Any questions, Clayton, at this time? Okay, we have several people signed up to speak on item number 6, starting with Carrie Collard, and Marco Barrett is next.
For the record, my name is Carrie Collard. Chairman and chairman members, I sat here in this room in July at a special hearing in September discussing the making of interim regulations concerning the deer industry at the end of the hunting season. Now I am attending today without any discussion with this industry as the hunting season begins. How can you tell the public you are going to do something and then do the complete opposite? I feel as a Texas resident that I cannot trust my government because their word means nothing. These emergency rules have crippled this industry and the landowners who purchase this product that are not even deer breeders. It has placed burdens on the breeders and landowners just because they purchased from a deer breeder. The regulations have decreased land values and have put a financial strain on me, deer breeders, landowners, and the Texas economy. I think integrity is at stake here. There is a process in which rules and regulations are made by state governments, and this Texas government should be held to the same standards. You as government officials have a duty to be honest, fair, listen, and discuss with both sides of an issue before you write or pass regulation. As a Texas resident, I feel that you have overstepped your boundaries on this issue. I am not a deer breeder. I am a concerned mother of two little boys being raised working in a deer breeding industry. I have taught my children values and how the state government is to work for the people. You have a duty to hear concerns from all the people. I have a problem with mandating landowners because they happen to purchase a breeder deer and then place a financial burden on them. These breeder deer have been liberated. They are no longer a breeder deer. They are wild deer. Before the emergency rule went into effect, hundreds and thousands of breeder deer have been liberated into the wild on these same release sites. You wiped the state clean across the board and considered them all wild and without risk. After your emergency rules, the breeder deer are released and not considered wild, and they are at risk because they came from a breeder pen. Okay, sorry. We raise deer in a permitted breeder pen and have regulations that protect our deer from being hunted and killed. Some groups seem to hide behind the TTP, TTT, and DMP programs, but in my opinion, they are breeding those deer illegally because they do not hold a breeder permit. They should be held to the same standards as a deer breeder and be held accountable. Deer liberated from a deer breeder permit are released onto private property and are no longer breeder deer. They are wild. These deer have the right to roam wild on the land, and the landowner has the right to hunt them just as the other groups do, without burdens placed on them because they came from a breeder pen. I vote no to the extension of these rules being placed. You need to hear all the people, not just a select few, before you regulate. Please stick to your word. And another thing, I don't think it was fair to sit up here and put new rules that were not exposed to the public to go ahead and pass them through real quick. I think that was pretty crappy. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Next is Marco Barrett.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Marco Barrett from San Antonio, Texas, and I'm in favor of the adoption of the interim rules as proposed. I'm the current president of the Texas Wildlife Association, a group of Texas landowners, wildlife managers, sportsmen, and conservationists, nearly 10,000 strong. But before that, I'm a hunter, I'm a landowner, I'm a wildlife manager. My family has both high and low fence property. We farm, we raise cattle, we lease for hunting, and we outfit for packaged hunts. I have property in Medina County, the county here in Texas where CWD was first found in a whitetail. We have used many of the varied programs and regulated permits that our state and the department has made available to landowners. On our Medina County property, we are permitted under Level 3 of the MLDP program. We have transferred deer into the Medina County Ranch, both with the Triple T program and from a permitted deer breeder. I have personally extracted brain stems to ship off to Texas Veterinary Medical Diagnostics Lab to qualify for move deer out of another ranch with a Triple T permit. I understand the sense of unease that comes from the what-if scenario that goes through a landowner's mind while waiting for those tests to come back. I will be testing this year voluntarily on my property because I believe it is the right thing to do. We need to have a better understanding of just where this disease is or has been as we move forward into the future. I am extremely hopeful that we will not find any more positives, but my optimism isn't paired with a high level of confidence. I commend the department and the Texas Animal Health Commission for erring on the side of caution by swiftly stopping movement once the disease was discovered, and also for working with varied stakeholder groups, managers, hunters, and landowners to provide a cautious way to allow for movement of deer before this hunting season via the currently in place emergency rules. A week after the discovery of the index positive, I and many of my friends who span the spectrum from large property, low fence landowners to small acreage, high fence breeders were having serious discussions questioning whether deer movement of any kind would be allowed at all this year. Let us not forget how far we have come in such a short period of time. I fully support the adoption of the rule as proposed and have faith that with the information and science garnered by the rule's required testing protocols during this season, the department is indicated in the rule discussion section. We're better equipped to consider modifying the testing protocols in the future, so we will continue to protect our state's deer herd, the hunters who depend on it for recreation, the landowners and managers who provide its habitat, while at the same time being mindful of the impacts on users of the tools in place. Thank you.
Marco, thank you for your comments. Next up is David Yates, and after that, Van Bruns.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, thank you for your time. For the record, my name is David Yates. I work for Texas Wildlife Association. In the interest of time, I'll keep this very brief. I want to speak specifically to the letter that's being delivered. That's a hard copy of the most updated version with the additional signatures that Mr. Wolf mentioned. I recognize there is a desire to amend the rules specifically to Class 2 release sites. The stubborn, unfortunate facts are that there we don't know if there is connectivity or not. We don't know who's connected and who is not. We haven't found the source of the initial index herd, and therefore I believe that we should err on the side of caution in moving forward. And I want to reiterate the Texas Wildlife Association is absolutely committed to retooling and revisiting these rules with the information at hand at the end of the season. I understand there's already about 1,500 non-captive samples collected already. Hunting season opens this weekend. I'm personally excited about that. I hope that we'll see a heavy tranche of new samples come in. I personally will be sampling for myself. Did want to point out that you certainly don't need us to explain the risks that we are potentially exposed to here. Thank goodness there are only four or five positives at this time. We may indeed find more. I hope that we do not. But rather than that be treated as an opportunity to back off and ease up, I think it demands responsible vigilance. This is an opportunity to nip this in the bud and react in a responsible manner. So with that, I'll close, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. And thank you for your wisdom and leadership.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes,
appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Thank you. Mr. Bruns. And after Mr. Bruns is Mr. Bender, Stephen Bender.
For the record, Van Bruns, deer breeder, 64 years old, about ready to retire, and the deer business is very important to me. I worked for H.B. Zachary as a contractor for a number of years and then went into pipe design. I don't have a pension, and I'm relying heavily on this. Why did I get in the deer breeding business? I wanted to tell you that. Back in the 90s, I was in DeWitt County, and deer numbers plummeted. Where there's a number of factors, you know, we have bulldozers and small acreage tracts in DeWitt County. And also, small acreage tracts and a drought. We went from 38,000 deer to 8,000 deer. Landowners were very unhappy. And what did the Parks and Wildlife do? They implemented a program, not their fault, to kill four does. So it hit DeWitt County at that time at a very bad time. People were very unhappy. Landowners, they had a meeting, in public meeting in DeWitt County, and it got out of control. So we have a passion. I love the white-tailed deer. I've been hunting since I could barely walk. So it's something we have a real passion for, love for. We make money at it. I'm a small guy. I've worked my way up from the bottom. And I talk to the guys that are on the bottom. Y'all want to affect the guys on the bottom? Believe me, you are. I've got a feed bill that I have to pay. I work my way up, probably $100,000 a year. So the decisions y'all make, going to decide whether those guys get paid or not. I was fortunate enough to sell my bucks this year, but I want you to know I had one call. No other calls. normally we don't have to advertise or do anything. Okay, now let's get to the chronic waste disease. I'm a level two. I buy deer and I sell deer. Okay, so what does that mean? I'm a level two. I don't just do 20% testing. I try to test all the deer that I possibly can. I don't have help on the place like a wildlife biologist. I work myself, do almost all the work myself. Okay, so what does that mean? I go to work on the, I also work, go to work before daylight and right time we have right now, and I get home after dark. So there is a possibility I'm going to miss a deer every once in a while as far as doing a test on them. But I'm guaranteeing you, I've tested all I possibly can. Haven't released any dead deer out into my pasture. Okay? So, level two, I've tested all these deer, and now when I release a deer out into my own site, I've got to kill some of those deer, and I've tested a bunch of them already. I'm not connected up. Now, I understand that we could have this disease totally gone, and I could still get it in my pen, because it could be brought in by what? Feed, hay. It could be in the ground already. So, just because I don't have it doesn't mean that I'm not going to get it. The other thing, you got the best level out there, and y'all are trying to tell us that they don't need to be tested going out. Okay, that's fine. I understand they've tested some deer and hadn't showed up, or maybe they tested every deer. But if they can get it out of the ground, out of feed and hay, how do you think they could not possibly have it? And what I'm saying is the level twos are definitely, I feel like I'm being discriminated against. I've tested my deer. I'm not a level, the best level, but I feel like I'm being discriminated against as a breeder. And I love the white-tailed deer just like anybody. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. Mr. Bender?
Good morning, Chairman Freakin, Commissioners, and Mr. Smith. I'm here today and speak in support of the proposed interim chronic wasting disease rules as put forward by the staff here at Texas Parks and Wildlife. For the record, my name is Stephen Bender. I work for the National Wildlife Federation, but today I represent NWF and our and Texas Conservation Alliance, our longtime affiliate and partner. At the National Wildlife Federation, my job is to work with sportsmen and women and to engage them in conserving the natural resources of this country. Our organization has more than 4 million members, supporters, and 500,000 of those are hunters and anglers. They are our roots, and we have been working with them for 80 years. I won't go into why we're here. We know that there have been two significant events over the last several years that have brought us to concern with CWD in both West Texas and Medina County. Every year, our NWF affiliates, and we have 49 of them, come together with our staff to discuss and debate affiliate-sponsored resolutions. Some of the most heated debate is around the care and protection of our servants in this country. Our first reference to chronic wasting disease was in 2000, when this disease was fairly tightly contained into a few different states. Now that has changed, and it's made its way around the country. We have made comments on behalf of our affiliates to the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, APHIS, concerning these issues as well. The tradition of hunting and fishing runs deep in this country and most certainly in Texas. Many people who hunt do so because they want to get out in nature, they want to get outdoors. And when successful, these hunters want to put meat in their freezers for their families to enjoy throughout the year. Hunters should not be concerned when afield about harvesting an unhealthy animal. They are concerned this has the potential to hurt hunting license sales and therefore decrease the revenue to this state agency. In-state hunters and our out-of-state friends want to hunt in Texas without fear or concern of the health of the animals they are harvesting. National Wildlife Federation and Texas Conservation Alliance support the actions taken by the biologists here at Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We trust the agency to manage this resource appropriately and from a scientific perspective. Therefore, we encourage the Commission to adopt the interim rules as laid out by the Wildlife Division, and we also encourage you to embark on a process that engages the best scientific minds inside and outside of the state to create a plan for postmortem and live testing and herd screening. Thank you for your time and consideration of this issue.
Thank you. And next up, you may have to help me with this a bit, Brent Geistwit.
For the sake of time, I'll withdraw.
Okay. And next up is Mike Ford.
Chairman, thank you for your time today. Commissioners, ladies and gentlemen, Carter, I see lots of people in this room we call stakeholders. I have a stake in everybody in this room's business. I've developed equipment personally that an international company in Mount Pleasant is building for us. Some of it I've sold to the Kerr Wildlife Management Area to further their knowledge and experience in what we're dealing with these animals. We all love them. I only beg and pray somewhere that as the commission court and Carter in his direction, that we find a science-based leader to teach us about this disease and let the passions that seems to have divided our wildlife community. I'm a member of every organization sitting in this room. Some of them is a life member. I joined the TWA when I played for the San Antonio Gunslingers for Clinton Mangus, and getting $100 to give TWA out of Clinton Mangus was a pretty tough deal back then for y'all that know Clinton. Bless his heart, he's gone today. But I just asked the court and the commissioners to have the foresight that lets science teach us. And if we can do things to help eradicate the disease through science-based facts, then we have to go that way. Today, in the communities of the wildlife that we're all involved in love, passion is what's directing us. Passion is what's dividing us. Only science can educate us. And I beg the commissioner's court to let that be the thing that we all strive to find. Somewhere in this deal, science has to tell us what we have to do. We know that science has proved us that disease won't make you sick. We could eat 100 pounds of backstrap this afternoon and nobody's going to get sick from eating it. We know that it's not going to depopulate a herd anywhere. They just released bison at the Colorado State University where they've done a brucellosis extraction from the gene. They just released those bison last week on the same property where they found CWD in the 1960s. How on earth can we have such a narrow mind of passion ruling something that science is the only answer to have? It took me 30 years to get out of college. I'm not the smartest guy in the room. I enjoyed every bit of it. I'd like to go back for a year, but I don't think that's going to happen at my time. But if we take our passions, we all have them. Each and every one of us in this room does. I have friends here. I have lots of friends. I've blown Clayton, Brad Chappell, and I are from the same county. I'm from Red River County. We talk about the deer in our pens not being wild. They're, in our eyes, they're livestock. We're producing a product for a consumer. In my county, and I see the light flashing, they had to catch deer in some counties to bring back to Red River County in the 1940s. I've seen the reports of it. We killed all the deer in Red River County out of need to eat. We killed all the turkeys, as I visited with Mr. Linder about this morning. We caught turkeys and took them back and reintroduced them. We caught deer in three counties, Zapata, Webb, and Johnson counties, and reintroduced them. So in my particular case, in Red River County, which is just shy of Oklahoma, if you know where that is, we didn't have those animals when I was a kid. I had no hunting season when I was a kid in Red River County because there was no deer. My forefathers and all their friends had shot all the deer and all the turkey to eat. We, as man and science, let us go get some animals to bring back to reintroduce. I don't think we're doing a whole lot different with that. And I'll say this, there is not one deer breeder anywhere in this room or anywhere in this state that ever would want anything bad to happen to any client or customer that ever come to them. We need to be the people leading that science fact. We've got the animals to test. We can do the homework. We can do the numbers to get to there. I beg the commission to use the science-based facts to lead our industry, and not our industry, but our state as a whole wildlife association. We got too many things pulling from outside this room. Well, this room needs to be together, not divided. I take the commissioner's time and thank all of y'all for that.
Appreciate your comments. Thank you very much, Mike. Thank you. Mr. Patrick Tarleton. And next up is Mike Wood.
Good afternoon, Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Patrick Tarleton. I'm the Executive Director of the Texas Deer Association.
on behalf of our membership, we oppose the adoption of the interim rules, chronic wasting disease response rules. This industry will never minimize CWD. For decades, deer ranchers in this state have led the way in CWD testing. No one is more committed to mitigating, controlling, and finding the source of CWD than my members. Our very livelihoods depend on it. The rules currently governing our industry were created in response to a perceived emergency that does not exist. Animal Health Commission and Parks have gained a wealth of knowledge of information which they did not have at the time of the creation and implementation of these rules. The abundance of caution upon which these rules were created must be balanced with the facts before us today. Sampling at the high-risk deer at the index facility yielded 4 positives. Conclusive tests on the remainder of the index facility had 0 positives. The single positive test result outside of the index herd can be directly traced back to the same pen and cohort at the index facility. I take extreme exception to the comments that we cannot assess connectivity. Through the use of the robust and innovative TWIM system we all utilize, we have identified, contained, and managed this incident of CWD in Texas. There is no statewide emergency. The system did work. Our industry has euthanized and tested more than 800 animals since July 1st. The absence of any additional positive test results significantly narrows the potential impact of CWD incident on this state, both in wild and captive herds. These results should immediately alter the dynamics of the rules governing our industry moving forward. The significant increase in CWD testing by breeder facilities should allow the department to release Class 2 release sites without impacting the important functions of the department on controlling the spread of the disease. This immediate relief would equalize testing across thousands of landowners that are completely unconnected to CWD Tier 1 facilities. The current testing and surveillance on Class 2 release sites required by emergency rules are significantly damaging our industry. I would ask you give this matter your prolonged consideration. You do not have to adopt these rules as written today. Making them permanent only validates decisions made in haste, with limited information, and based on a completely different set of facts than we are looking at today. Additionally, if these rules are truly interim, we should not include consequences lasting 2 years. Regulators and industry must work together to maintain the certain balance of private property rights, economic impact, and disease management. The deer industry is in dire need of a permitting process that provides regulatory certainty while maintaining a climate conducive to business growth. We know challenges lie ahead. The Deer Association and all my members are committed to working alongside regulators to find a path forward that balances fair and appropriate rules that take into account the economic livelihood of a central rural Texas industry like ours. Thank you for your time.
Patrick, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Mike Wood. Next up is Tim Condit.
Greetings, Chairman Friedkin, Commissioners, Mr. Smith. First off, I'd just like to say I love that we live in a country and a state where we're all allowed to get up and voice our opinion. I appreciate all of your time, the state employees' time, Animal Health, Parks and Wildlife has devoted an undue amount of time and the sleepless hours and the abundance of work they've put in. Since this was found in late June, early July, I think us as ranchers have had very much similar unrest and through this entire process. It's cost many Texans their property, their livelihoods, their health, and even some their marriages. Temporary emergency, according to Webster, temporary, lasting for only a limited period of time, not permanent. Emergency. A serious, unexpected situation requiring immediate action. Well, we got the emergency part down pretty good. The temporary part we're still working on. Emergency rules, according to Texas Code, 120 days followed by 2 sets of 30 days each. I implore you to act upon the temporary part and realize that Parks and Wildlife has been planning for this exact situation since 2005. when the importation of deer into Texas was stopped, and as recent as a few years ago in far west Texas. Guys, they've had the time. They've put the plans together. Let's let them work. Implementing these temporary orders to permanent status or extending them, I believe, is a bad precedent. You have not educated the hunters, the landowners, the lessees, the lessors. There's been nothing to these people who have deer on their properties. And I've received calls from people, neighbors, and so forth. One of my neighbors is the executive director of the Dallas Safari Club. That's a pretty big organization. He's asking me what to do. I don't know. What's going to happen if it's found on my land and I've voluntarily submitted? I don't know. I've worked lots with Mitch Lockwood. I want to applaud Mitch for every time since this has started, I have called Mitch and he's instantly answered the phone. He's never sent it to voicemail. He's never said, you know, I can't help you. And before this, I've had good relations with Mitch, and I know that's blinking, but I just got to say that. But even Mitch couldn't answer what's going to happen to you if it's found. Well, I got three words for you. 3 Mile Island. Your land's toxic. If you really want to find this, we need to really start testing. We need to test everywhere, not just voluntarily. We need to test everywhere. TTP, those deer are already terminal. They're dead. Let's test them. You've got free animals right there to test. I beg of you to let the emergency order expire before more good, honest, hardworking Texans are forced into a bad situation. Many ranchers like myself release bred does in the spring, and carrying this rule forward to August of 2016 will be taxing at best and dangerous more dangerous than many have even considered. Let the rule expire as we were told, or simply put, you can shorten the MLDP season by 2 weeks when many of the folks are already through with their hunting, and by usurping this emergency rule procedure to simply cover the last 2 weeks of the MLDP season, I feel is improper and reckless in many eyes as well. The proper action will be to proceed with caution, let the tests conducted, then reviewed, come in, let the science and information disseminate where we go from there, and all points moving forward. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Tim Condon. And next up is Evelyn Mertz.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, thank you for allowing me to make comment on the rule. I feel strongly on the importance of our industry, not only in Texas, but across our great nation. We create jobs, we pay taxes, we work hard, and we give families the opportunity to live their dream of raising great children in a rural environment, allowing parents to instill the ethics, morals, and values into those children through the responsibility of a day's work of doing chores on a deer farm. It would be wonderful if every child in this country could be raised in this manner. We are a very patriotic and freedom-loving people. We love our country, and we love Texas. Across the nation, we have volunteered to be the canary in a coal mine. We test our animals at a much higher rate for disease than animals on the outside of our fences. We work hard to be a part of the solution by helping show when a problem possibly exists. When we do find something, we are put out of business and our dreams are lost. We do what we do not to get rich, but simply because we love our particular species so much that we can't imagine not being able to surround ourselves with these animals, learning and loving every minute spent. Over time, I feel there's been a level of distrust built between this agency and deer breeders across Texas. I am not here to point fingers. I am here to be part of a solution. We should all be part of a team. We all want what's best for the future of hunting, and we all want what's best for a future filled with people being able to spend time and learn the same respect for the great outdoors that we all share. I think the people who work and take direction from the members of this commission would agree that I am a very open and honest with them and express my opinion of agreement or disagreement in a non-obstructive way. I have sincerely appreciated the way that the gentleman that the commission oversees has worked with me and given me the opportunity to express my opinion in a non-obstructive way. I find myself reading proposals for rules that include language that I feel can be misinterpreted or detrimental to our industry. I think we would be better served if a couple of the representatives from our industry had opportunities to work in an earlier stage of every process to eliminate unforeseen issues. It is hard sometimes to understand how rules and laws will affect breeders unless you are one. The route of CWD throughout the body of cervix is totally predictable. It first shows up in the lymph node, then the tonsil, to the brain, and then to the rectal lining. From the time it shows up in the lymph node to the tonsil, according to the best research people in the nation, is less than 2 months. The tonsil test is 100% accurate if CWD has reached the tonsil. People lead you to believe it is hard to accomplish this test. It takes 20 seconds once an animal is has been knocked out. That is absolutely not true. We have people in quarantine situations that are losing their livelihoods and dreams that we can test out. Please allow me to help work out these situations. The DBC believes many deer were wasted through the retroactive 4.5% testing of animals that were not in trace outs, costing our industry over $5 million. We believe this could have been done going forward and avoided that loss. We feel the emergency no longer exists, and the information with the information we now have, we believe that testing breeders in hunt and hunt facilities is double jeopardy on the animals, and testing in hunt facilities is crippling our industry. Because of these reasons, we cannot support these emergency rules. However, I would like to say that I really have appreciated the effort that's been put forth on behalf of Texas Parks and Wildlife extended to me. And I thank you, Carter Smith and Clayton Wolf and Mitch Lockwood, for the work that they have done with me, because I do appreciate how they've reached out to me, and I've reached out to them. And the DVC would like to extend an invitation to put me in Austin, Texas, however long it takes, to stay in a motel down here and assist working out these situations with particular breeders that are caught in quarantine situations that will put them out of business. Thank you for your time, and thank you for listening.
I thank you for your thoughtful comments. Appreciate it very much. Ms. Evelyn Mertz.
Good morning, Carter, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Evelyn Mertz. I'm here representing the Lone Star Chapter of the Sierra Club. To us, this is a very straightforward issue. The solution to this issue is found in the name of the agency, Texas Parks and Wildlife. The agency's responsibility is to protect the state's wildlife population for the benefit of all the people, not just for the benefit of a special interest group. This goes to the heart of the public trust doctrine. The interim rule is a necessary, reasonable, fact-based, and thoughtful response to protect the wild deer herd from the transmission of chronic wasting disease from private deer hunting facilities. The Lone Star Chapter strongly supports the interim rule, not the permanent, the interim rule, and urges the Commission to adopt it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And for the record, Mr. Tom Vandeveer wishes to register a position for the adoption of interim proposed rules, and Mr. Craig Wilson wishes to register a position against the adoption of proposed interim rules. They did not wish to speak. And that, I believe, is everyone that signed up to speak on item number 6. Is there any discussion by the commission? I have a question from Commissioner Duggins.
It's actually a question I'd like to ask of Dr. Schwartz, if you wouldn't mind coming up, please, sir. Does the Animal Health Commission consider the rules that are proposed for adoption reasonable and prudent from a disease management standpoint?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Andy Schwartz. I'm Assistant Executive Director with the Texas Animal Health Commission. And Commissioner Duggins, the short answer to your question is yes. We would say that even before this first case of CWD was found in white-tailed deer and pinned deer in Texas, our agencies have worked together. The Texas Animal Health Commission and Texas Parks and Wildlife, our leadership, saw the need to do that. Although we have differing missions, we knew that we needed to come to the same table because we both have a card in this game of protecting white-tailed deer. So we supported the stopping of movement of deer while the epidemiological investigation was taking place. We were, as Mr. Wolf has said earlier, We were involved in the discussions about how to resume movement, how to allow the industry to resume some normalcy and still mitigate any risk that's still there, still was presented by this case of chronic wasting disease. As it's been stated earlier, we still don't know the source of infection in this particular herd, and so I think there it warrants some caution moving forward. We do need extra surveillance that's being accomplished this year through the hunting season, through the additional testing that was done to qualify herds for movement. We plan to come back to the table with Texas Parks and Wildlife and consider this information that's gathered through additional investigation, through hunting surveillance, and make any recommendations to change the rule. But again, we see ourselves as sitting at the door. The actions that our agencies take could have a long-term effect on the health of the deer population in Texas, and I think caution is warranted. So we do support this rule.
Thank you, sir.
Can I ask a question of Clayton Wolf?
Please.
Clayton, I just have a quick question. A couple of comments mentioned the science, which is obviously very important to us as well, and education of the stakeholders, the landowners, the deer breeders. What are we doing, if anything, both on the science side and the education side, testing procedures, even live testing? Are we doing anything in that regard, or do we have something planned in that regard?
Yes, Commissioner. On the science side, in the time period that we had, we obviously relied upon the expertise of Texas Animal Health Commission, our veterinarian, to pull together the scientific information we had. The short answer, because many of the comments are related to anti-mortem or live animal testing, was really there was no protocol in place to be able to do that without really creating gridlock. But as we've indicated before, the purpose of our January symposium really is going to be to pull all the national experts on not just on live animal testing, but on the impacts of CWD. You know, so there's a lot that's unknown, and so that's fertile ground for speculation on what population level impacts might be. And so for January, we're going to bring together all the experts and put that together in a forum that all the stakeholders will be able to have access to, and then we're going to use that as a springboard as we move forward, because we do feel like we can be leaders, we can be innovative. We don't necessarily need USDA approval if we're going to develop standards for intrastate movement using a live animal test, but we need to parameterize really those aspects of the test, and that's the part that we did engage some of our staff statisticians, and what is concerning is when you look at probabilities of detecting this disease, particularly this type of the disease, it is tough to detect. And so some of the sampling levels we've had in the past, really the statisticians tell us it could take decades to find the disease. And so what we want to do is bring the scientists together along with the statisticians. So not only can we look at the technique of how you get a sample and how sensitive that CWD sample is, but also convert that to something that means something for us. How long would it take, or what is the probability of detecting disease in this population or in this herd? And so we'll do a more comprehensive look into that in January, and that will be all that material will be part of the decision making process when we come to you in March. As far as education goes, our partners at Texas AgriLife Extension have really taken the lead. We have been part of numerous seminars and outreach meetings throughout the state. In fact, there was one in San Antonio last night, and I think Mitch went down there to represent the department, and I've been involved in some in Bandera and Hondo and other places. We'll have them in Austin and Houston, San Antonio. So outreach, just general outreach to get to hunters and landowners and talk about the disease, that has also taken place, and Texas AgriLife Extension has really played a critical role in helping us do that.
Okay. Did it answer all your questions?
It did. When you look at, have you scheduled a date in January yet for that symposium?
We have not. We've got a week that we have penciled in right now, but obviously we've got to try to get a hold of all the experts to make sure we can get them here. But we're looking at the middle of January right now as our target. But we haven't scheduled anything yet.
Okay. Would you make sure you talk to the stakeholders before that scheduling, because I'd like to make sure that as many of them can be there and it doesn't interrupt hunting season and whatnot that they may have. I just want to make sure you get as many of them there as you can.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Discussion? Okay, do we have a motion on item 6?
I'll move.
Moved by Commissioner Morian.
Second.
Second by Commissioner Jones. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, hearing none, the interim rules carry. Thank you. Item 7 is land acquisition, Matagorda County, 6,554 acres on the Matagorda Peninsula. Mr. Ted Hollingsworth. Hi, Ted. Good morning. Still morning.
Chairman, commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. And at the risk of changing the subject, I'd like to talk briefly about Matagorda Peninsula. We briefed the commission on this potential acquisition back in August and are returning to discuss action. Matagorda Peninsula is in southern Matagorda County. The peninsula itself ranges in width from 800 feet to about a mile wide. About 22 miles long, separates the Gulf of Mexico from East Matagorda Bay. The eastern two-thirds of that tract is owned by the General Land Office. At one time it was a state park, but in 1997 legislation arranged for that, for some exchange of assets. The property went to the General Land Office, and the coastal conservation community has been looking for opportunities to put that property back into conservation since then. With the Deepwater Horizon spill and the funding opportunities or mitigation opportunities that have come from that, we have been working with our partners and with our trustee partners, with the Restore Council, with the NERDA trustees, and we propose to acquire this property and add it to the inventory of the Coastal Fisheries Division to be managed as a coastal preserve using restore funding. 6,500 acres in interest. Most of that is 100% interest. There are some undivided interest in those tracts. The property is just really, really very, very, very high conservation value for migratory and resident wading birds, waterfowl, sea turtles nest on those beaches, just very, very high conservation values. The property is quite remote, and for that reason, we feel like it warrants protection while we have that opportunity. This map shows that, again, most of that property is 100% owned by the General Land Office. Some of those tracts are 99% owned or are less. There are some inholdings in some of those tracts. Just want to be very clear about that. At the same time, the opportunity to conserve 11 miles of Gulf beaches and East Matagorda Bay, we consider to be worth taking this opportunity, especially with the opportunity with the potential for restore funding for this. The Restore Council has placed this one on their FPL, their funding priority list, which will be finalized next month. We're confident that that this is one that the Restore Council will advocate funding for, and we want to get ahead of that and ask the Commission to approve that acquisition when those funds become available. We've received two public comments, both in favor of the acquisition, and with that, the staff recommends that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorizes the Executive Director to take all necessary steps to acquire approximately 6,554 acres on Matagorda Peninsula to manage for conservation of fish and wildlife. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the Commission for Ted? And nobody is signed up to speak on this item. No questions. Motion for approval. Oh. You have a question? Okay. Moved by Commissioner Jones, second by Commissioner Morian. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Ted, you're back at it with item 8, grant of utility easement, Brazoria County, approximately 0.4 acres at the Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item is brought to you as a result of a request from Phillips 66 Petroleum and CenterPoint Energy to provide a service drop for a valve station on the Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area. Phillips has an easement across the Justin Hurst that they've had since long before we acquired the property. They've installed some new pipelines, and they've installed a valve station, very necessary for safety and for managing the flow in those valves. The valve station requires electricity, electrical power. The valve station is very close to an existing center point easement. This is the general location in the north part of the wildlife management area where these two easements occur. They're separated by a very short distance, and staff has taken a close look at this now and determined that truly the most expedient way and the best way to minimize impacts to fish and wildlife resources at the wildlife management area is to grant this short easement that would allow CenterPoint Energy to provide that drop for those valve for that valve station for Phillips 66. CenterPoint and Phillips 66 have both worked closely with us to find this to find the shortest route possible to get that power to the valve station and to minimize harm to the wildlife management area in the process. We've received no public comments on this one, and staff does recommend that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. The commission adopts the resolution attached as Exhibit A, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ted? Commissioner Duggan.
Does the what you label as the existing easement, does that have a term on it, or is it in perpetuity? Or
it's in perpetuity.
And if the use is discontinued, do we have the option of leaving the lines in the ground or requiring the easement holder to remove?
Yes, sir. In fact, all of the easements we've issued for a number of years now give us the exclusive option to have the infrastructure removed or left in place at our discretion.
And so the new proposed easement shown in red would contain the same terms?
Yes, sir.
And would they be tied to the existing easement? So if the existing easement went away, they go away?
We could certainly make sure that that's clear in the easement, yes, sir.
I don't think that would affect their use, but I would suggest that the new easements, if the commission approves them, state that if the, quote, existing easement goes away, that these go away too.
We can easily make that a condition of the easement. That's a good point, yes, sir.
Thank you. Or with that, I'll move approval.
Okay, moved by Commissioner Duggins.
Second.
Commissioner Scott, all in favor? Any opposed? Hearing none, that motion carries. Item number 9, grant of utility easement, Brazoria County, about 37 acres at the Justin Hurst WMA, has been withdrawn. And item number 10, acceptance of land donation, Cameron County, in holdings totaling approximately 15 acres of Boca Chica State Park. Mr. Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. We have a state park facility in Cameron County, just a couple miles north of the mouth of the Rio Grande River. That facility, Boca Chica State Park, is currently leased to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and managed as part of their Rio Grande Refuge system. When we acquired that property, there were a couple of subdivisions that we acquired at the same time. A number of tracts had already been sold, and although very, very little development has occurred on those tracts, they are in holdings. As most of you know, there was a 49-acre tract that the state park property sort of wrapped around that was acquired by SpaceX for a space vehicle launch site for health and safety reasons, as well as for compliance with FAA regulations. SpaceX has been acquiring those in holdings within the state park within a certain radius of their facility, and they have no interest in managing those odd tracts of land. and are proposing to transfer those to Texas Parks and Wildlife. The park's about 1,100 acres. It's a really, if you haven't been to that part of Texas, it really is truly unique. And of course, any of those tracts we can acquire are going to facilitate our operation and, of course, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service operation of that fish and wildlife habitat there at that property. The white box there shows where most of those inholdings are. Again, that was conceived to be a neighborhood at one time, although no homes have been built in that area. And most of those, although not all of those odd tracts, are in that. What we're asking the commission to do is authorize the executive director to accept those tracts as SpaceX acquires them and offers them to us. We put one caveat on that, and that is that we're going to put somebody on the ground to look at each of those tracts to make sure there's no underground storage tanks or other obvious environmental liabilities before we accept them. Obviously, the more of those inholdings we can eliminate in the state park property, the easier it's going to be for operation and management of that property going forward. We've received no public comments on this potential action, and the staff recommends that the commission adopt the following motion. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorizes the executive director to take all necessary steps to accept the donation of inholdings within Boca Chica State Park in Cameron County. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Ted. Any questions? Motion for approval on this item? Commissioner Duggan, second. Commissioner Scott, all in favor? Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Ted, I think you get a break for a second. So item number 11 is land acquisition, Cochran County, approximately 5 acres at Yoakum Dunes, WMA.
Yeah, for the record, I'm not Ted Hollingsworth. So Porky Coleman with the Land Conservation Program. Good morning. Y'all have been hearing a while for the last couple of years as we've been putting together this wildlife management area in Yoakum Dunes. Cochran, Yoakum, and Terry Counties, Texas. Well, staff, the total WMA is now about 1,400 acres. Staff has had the need or found the need to have a headquarters complex to serve this area, and we decided we should look outside of the area out of prime chicken habitat. A minimum of 5 acres, high priority chicken habitat out of it, and reasonable distance of the WMA and utilities available. We were lucky enough and fortunate enough to find a willing seller for this type of track. It's about 5 miles north of the WMA. It's noted there by the Red Star. It is from a willing seller. The track has 440 feet of paved county road frontage. The west side access will be, the owners will deed us an easement along the west side. If you look at that, the green polygon is what we'll be purchasing. The area just to the west of that is leased to an oil field. It's 3 acres leased to an oil field for a maintenance area. They are going to give us a right of first refusal on that 3 acres if they ever decide to sell it. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Commissioner Douglas.
You said, you misspoke, you said 1,400 acres, you meant 14,000.
14,000, excuse me, yes, 14,000.
Thank you.
If there's no other questions, staff recommends the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorizes the executive director to take all necessary steps to acquire approximately 5 acres as an addition to Yoakum Dunes Wildlife Management Area.
Okay, motion for approval. Any other questions? Motion for approval. Commissioner Morin, second. Commissioner Jones, all in favor? Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thank you, Corky. Item 12, Sanjak Waste Pit Settlement, $10 million appropriation to Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for environmental grants. Mr. Ted Hollingsworth. It's afternoon now.
It is. Chairman, Commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Ted Hollingsworth, and I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This is a briefing item. We just want to take a few minutes and let the commission know what's going on with this particular appropriation. Some of you may know that down in Harris County, just a couple of miles north of San Jacinto, there's a Superfund site. Back in the 1960s, a waste company levied off some marshes and dumped waste from a paper mill. And I only did that for 2 or 3 years, but they filled those pits up. and in short order with subsidence and erosion and other things, those pits began to leak into the San Jacinto River. The most toxic are the chemicals of greatest concern for health and of wildlife and people are dioxins. In 2008, the site was declared a Superfund site. In 2011, the EPA stepped in and put a temporary cap over that site. Research into whether that cap is sufficient or not, research into how much dioxin has been released, research into the effects of that dioxin on fish and wildlife and the potential human consumption of fish and wildlife are ongoing. There are also other legal actions ongoing at this time. But in 2011, Harris County filed a suit. The county itself filed a suit against the operators of the waste pits, as well as the producer of the waste. And last year, they arrived at a settlement of $29.2 million. Under state law, $10 million of that went to the state. The county asked the state to convey that $10 million to Texas Parks and Wildlife to be then granted back to the county to be used on projects that would mitigate impacts to Fish and Wildlife Service and also impacts to the human access to and use of those river facilities. And the legislature did in fact pass legislation appropriating that $10 million to Texas Parks and Wildlife. You can see in this slide again that those pits are just a couple miles north of the San Jacinto battleground. We've already executed an MOU with Harris County that defines how those funds will be used. Texas Parks and Wildlife is going to play the role of coordinating a proposal process. We'll work with the county to identify the projects we think best meet the intent of the legislation, and we'll do the most long-term benefit for fish and wildlife resources in the lower San Jacinto River and help educate the public and give the public access to those river resources. Once we've agreed on those projects, we'll enter into a new MOU that lists those projects. We'll convey that $10 million to Harris County. And at that point, Harris County will be solely responsible for doling out those funds to the project sponsors, tracking those funds, making sure that there's compliance with the intent of the legislation and so forth. So at that point, Texas Parks and Wildlife will be out of the process. But over the next few months, we do expect to work with the public in Harris County and with the county to identify those projects that $10 million would be best used to fund. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about that $10 million appropriation.
Questions for Ted?
Ted, I noticed on the under the grant schedule, you said there's going to be a local public meeting.
Yes, sir.
To inform potential applicants how to apply for projects.
Sir.
I would suggest we put something on the website too, for people who, again, trying to drive our business through our website. I would suggest that in addition to the meeting.
We've given our web team a heads up that once we have that time and date established, that we'd like for them to put a link with that information on our website.
A link about the meeting or how to apply? Because what I'm talking about is give them some of the same information that will be conveyed at the meeting for those who cannot come to the meeting but might want to apply.
Yes, sir, both. Yep. That's correct. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And I would just mention about the public meeting. At this point, we don't intend to host that meeting. The county asked us to be involved because there's a perception, and I think rightly so, that we're a impartial third party and can help select those processes without maybe some of the local biases involved for the best benefit of fish and wildlife and for the best recreational and educational value of those dollars. So we'll be present. But we anticipate that the meeting itself will be hosted locally. There is a citizens group down there that's already taken a very active role in educating the public about this whole process, and we're working with them as well as with the county.
Any other questions, discussion for Ted? Thank you. Item number 13, Ted, is Ted again on Texas Farm and Ranch Lands Conservation Program. Transfer the program to TPW.
Chairman, commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This is another briefing item. I believe all of you are familiar with the Texas Farm and Ranch Lands Conservation Program and the fact that the 84th Legislature transferred that program from the General Land Office to Texas Parks and Wildlife. The purpose of the program is to make funds available for the acquisition of conservation easements on working lands. I think everybody who's looked at the statistics realizes that we are losing ranch land and farmland in Texas at an alarming rate. And in 2005, the legislature created a program for the purpose of making funds available to nonprofit, mostly to NGOs, land trusts specifically, for the purpose of acquiring easements on working lands. The legislature did not provide appropriation, did not appropriate state dollars for that program. The GLO did manage to get some funds out of CAP to fund that program for a few years. But the purpose of the program is to make dollars available to land trusts to acquire conservation easements on working lands to try and preserve some of the best of the farm and ranch land in Texas. The statute gives a priority to those lands that are adjacent to or contribute to other conservation lands, lands that are threatened, that are most threatened with fragmentation, threatened with development, and that are productive working lands. The legislature did appropriate $2 million to Texas Parks and Wildlife to get this program up and running over this coming biennium. We're already very actively working on a grant selection process, application forms, that we hope the very early next year to roll that out and to start requesting proposals from the NGO, the land trust community. The statute also provides for a council. The statute increased the number of members on that council to 12. Just this last week or so, the governor has appointed the two vacancies on that council, and we anticipate that when the program is officially transferred to the department on January 1st, that shortly thereafter we'll convene that council and ask that council to approve the selection criteria, the grant process that we're working on now. We are working closely with several land trusts already in anticipation of their interest in this program. We're working with our NRCS to see if there's a way to leverage those state dollars with federal farm bill dollars to increase the number of conservation easements that we'll be able to fund in this coming biennium. The department will be managing the program. It'll be managed in the Land Conservation Program shop. And, of course, we will work very closely with the council to make sure that they have the oversight responsibility intended by the legislature. They will be approving the suite of grant proposals that are recommended by staff. And in a nutshell, here's the composition of the board. The chairman of this commission is also the chairman of the council. There are six of those positions are appointed by the governor again. Those top two, Ms. Pam McAfee and Mr. George Scott, were recently appointed to serve six-year terms on that council. Again, we anticipate that by January we'll be ready to seat that council and present them with our recommendations for a grant process, selection criteria, and in general, policies and procedures for moving forward with the Farm and Ranch program. Again, here's that schedule. We hope that by spring we're able to select the projects that are most appropriate and make those awards. We're also very hopeful that there will be a tremendous demand. We think there will be. We'd like to be able to go into the next legislative session saying that, you know, there's a large unmet need, a large unmet demand for opportunities for families to place their working lands under conservation easement. We get calls here regularly from the owners of working lands concerned that either when they die or when the taxes get too high or any number of reasons, they're concerned about what tools might be available for keeping those lands intact and working. We think, as an agency, we believe, obviously we believe in private lands and the role that private lands play in conservation. And personally, I'm very excited that we're going to have another tool in that toolbox to help the owners of working lands keep those lands working and keep them in conservation at the same time. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about the Farm and Ranch program.
Thank you, Ted. Any questions? Any discussion? Appreciate it. Thanks for the update and the briefing.
That's right.
Okay, Mr. Smith, this commission has completed its business, and I declare us adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.